We in the United States need to stand up and speak up. Many of us in Congress are going to do just that.
U.S. lawmakers weigh their response to the Rohingya crisis. It's Monday, October 30th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Philippines president softens tone on United States. The Great Barrier Reef finding new life. High-tech cars displayed in Tokyo. Finding the truth and climate change impact. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Since August 25th, more than 600,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled the majority Buddhist Myanmar for neighboring Bangladesh. When Myanmar's security forces began targeting the Rohingya in response to Rohingya militant attacks on police stations. As President Donald Trump prepares to make his first trip to Asia, the U.S. response has been less than clear. The U.S. Congress is considering a range of options to pressure Myanmar to stop the deadly military attacks. Lawmakers are considering a standalone sanctions bill, but activists lobbying for the Rohingya say a White House executive order could have the most immediate impact. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, is the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on Immigration, and he shares with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren his observations on what is going on in Myanmar towards the Rohingya and opinion and what's the official position of the United States on the issue.
I don't know the official position of this administration, but the kindest take on this is ethnic cleansing. That's the kindest take. And my colleagues, Ben Cardin of Maryland, called it a genocide. Whatever it is, we in the United States need to stand up and speak up. Many of us in Congress are going to do just that.
Why should this be important to the American people? It's so far away.
When it comes to American greatness, one of the things that we point to is when we stand up for things, values that count all around the world. These people, Muslim people, Rohingya people, are being terrorized by the Myanmar military. Their homes are being burned, they're being killed and raped and displaced in hundreds of thousands of numbers. They're put into refugee camps across the Naf River in Bangladesh and live under the worst, most deplorable, dangerous conditions. That's just unacceptable.
Well, according to the law in Burma, Myanmar, is in 1982, when they gave a number of ethnic groups citizenship, they specifically eliminated the Rohingyas. Why are they so resistant to letting the Rohingyas occupy that area?
Their argument, as I understand it, is they're not really citizens of Burma or Myanmar. They're really from Bangladesh. They are Bengali. And secondly, I don't think it escapes attention, they are Muslim. In a country where there is a Muslim population, but they are a concentration of a million or more Muslims within that country that has never been assimilated or accepted.
Well, apparently some of the people in the military in Myanmar say that these are terrorists.
And there was a terrorist incident, or at least a killing. You can characterize it as you wish. 16, we understand, Myanmar soldiers or law enforcement were killed. It was after some exchanges, some killing on both sides. But to argue that the response to that should be the displacement of 600,000 people is an outrage. It really went way beyond calling to justice those who are responsible, and it clearly is ethnic cleansing by classic definition.
And you're speaking about the August 25th attack, and since then all these people, they basically had a scorched earth policy, and there's been rape, there have been villages burned down, and they're trying to push them out of the Rakhine area of Myanmar.
Yes, the northern Rakhine in particular. You know, we invited seven senators, Democrats and Republicans, he invited the ambassador from Myanmar to come to my office yesterday, and he sat with us for over an hour and took our questions, and we'll get back to us in a week or two about his progress. What we're trying to do is to tell him we are watching carefully. Any relationship we have with Myanmar is going to be dependent on the outcome of this situation, and we expect results quickly.
Well, you've introduced a resolution condemning it, and you had bipartisan support.
I believe we will.
You have legislation coming.
I can tell you that the original resolution, John McCain joined me, and we think others will too. Yes, it will be bipartisan. But we don't want to wait for the passage of this resolution, as symbolic as it may be. We want results. I mean, there are people who are suffering at this point and dying. And we called on this government, called on Aung San Suu Kyi, to really step up, speak up, and do something. First, bring in some third parties, United Nations, NGOs, into Northern Rakhine, where they are currently being excluded, so they can see on the ground what's happening. Second, hold those responsible in the Myanmar military who burned these villages and were involved in these atrocities. Third, if there's going to be repatriation, bring in the UNHCR, the High Commission on Refugees, to bring these people back in an orderly way, demanding papers from people who have been completely displaced from their homes and their homes burned in front of them is unrealistic.
How do you get the U.S. Senate interested in this, the whole Senate? There's a lot of talk about tax reform, and we've got health care, we've got a lot of fighting going on. How do you convince the U.S. Senate that this is something that, you know, that they should focus on?
I think, you know, Senator Young, Republican of Indiana, Senator McCain, and others are willing to stand up with us and make it a bipartisan effort. We're going to have an opportunity. There'll be a bill passed before the end of the year about the next year's budget. Some of it involves our relationship with Myanmar and the money that is given to them. If we can see real progress, if we're moving to solve this problem, it's going to be a much more positive outcome for Myanmar.
Do you think the world watches us on issues like this?
I think they do. You know, America has been, we're not perfect by any means, but we have really been a leader when it comes to speaking out in these circumstances. And I will never forget, Greta, my predecessor, Paul Simon, begging the Clinton administration, do something about Rwanda, do something. They didn't. 800,000 people died.
So we're essentially, like during Rwanda's, we're watching ethnic cleansing or genocide. We're watching it happen.
We are, sadly. And when I see the pictures, I was with the Rohingya population in Chicago. We have over 1,000 in Chicago. They have their own center. I visited with them last week. They showed me the photos from these refugee camps. They're horrible. The line for food was a mile long. The line for food. Think about that, with tens and 100,000 people gathered with virtually no public health care, no drinkable water, cholera starting to show its face. All of these things demand that we move quickly.
Senator Dick Durbin speaking with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren. Meanwhile, Myanmar police said Saturday they have detained two foreign journalists who were employed by Turkish state media for flying a drone over parliament grounds in the capital of Naypyidaw. Several other journalists have been arrested in Myanmar this year, triggering warnings from rights groups. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Asia looks for signals on policy ahead of Trump visit to region. Singapore's Lee offers insights on Trump and China relations. China objects to Taiwan's president's visits to United States. Thousands march in support of Myanmar military. Myanmar charges foreign journalists and others for flying a drone. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. With a visit by U.S. President Trump next month, the Philippine president has changed his tone of late when it comes to the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman reports the Philippine leader, Rodrigo Duterte, is known for his often profanity-laden tirades against the United States.
In the recent past, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has chided Washington for treating the Philippines, as he put it, like a dog. A year ago, during a visit to Beijing, Duterte announced his separation from the United States, declaring he had realigned with China as the two agreed to resolve their South China Sea dispute through talks. But despite human rights groups' condemnation of Duterte's drug crackdown, in which thousands of people have been killed, U.S. President Donald Trump praised the Philippine leader for doing what Trump called an unbelievable job on the drug problem. Rodrigo Duterte said Sunday he would deal with the U.S. President Donald Trump righteously.
I would deal with President Trump in the most righteous way. Welcome him as an important leader, as a matter of fact, the important leader on this side of the planet. And I would have to also listen to him, what he has to say. My responses would be calibrating of what he would ask me.
President Trump's Asian journey begins November 3rd. The Philippine visit to Manila is on the last leg of his trip, with visits to Japan, South Korea, China, and Vietnam to attend the ASEAN Leaders Summit on the schedule first. In a media briefing Sunday before leaving for Japan to meet Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Duterte further listed his menu of what he wanted to discuss.
It would be terrorism, cooperation between the two countries, the fight against drugs. And all of this, I said, expect to be dealing with him around these topics.
Thank you, sir.
And of course, I forgot the main, what the opening agenda would really be Korea. We are worried, all of us, that, Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong.
Duterte previously described the North Korean leader Kim as a fool and profanely criticized him for playing with dangerous toys. Trump will meet with Duterte in Manila, but will skip a larger meeting in the Philippines with heads of states and governments from China, South Korea, Japan, India, Australia, and New Zealand. Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
Happening now in Asia, poet Fei Chiang, who championed Asian American culture, has died at age 65. Ms. Chiang's poetry reflected her anxieties as a first-generation Chinese American and her work as a community activist in New York City. Her quest to understand her identity as a child of Chinese immigrants found outlets in vivid poetry. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The health of one of Australia's greatest natural treasures, the Great Barrier Reef, is improving, according to a new government study. But as Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, environmentalists say the report has failed to address the contentious political issue of land clearing.
The joint report by the Queensland State Government and its federal counterparts shows that pollution flowing into the Great Barrier Reef has declined. Farmers are praised for reducing the amount of harmful fertilisers, pesticides and other contaminants running from their properties into coastal waters. But poor water quality, exacerbated by runoff from farms, continues to be one of the most significant threats to the long-term health of the reef, which stretches about 2,300 kilometres down the northeast coast of Australia. The joint government assessment of the reef concedes that better land management practices are needed. The World Heritage body UNESCO has threatened to put the Great Barrier Reef on its in danger list because of environmental concerns. Stephen Miles, the Queensland State Environment Minister, says work to protect the world's largest coral system is continuing.
We did accelerate our investment and our activity in subsequent years. I'm confident that the World Heritage Committee will continue to recognise the progress that the Queensland and Australian governments have made in more recent years. That's what their most recent report said.
But conservationists insist the report ignores the impact of massive tree clearing in Queensland, which they believe threatens to unleash more pollution into the Great Barrier Reef. The state government has also struggled to bring in contentious new laws to stop farmers chopping down trees. Sean Hubin from WWF Australia, a conservation group, says the problem of land clearing can't be ignored.
There's a huge amount of sediment coming in from cleared land, and until the data is properly incorporated, the government can't be claiming pollution reductions when major factors like tree clearing aren't actually included.
More than 2 million tourists visit the Great Barrier Reef each year, including growing numbers from China, South Korea and Japan. The reef is the size of Italy and has been subjected to mounting environmental threats, including rising sea temperatures, overfishing and the industrialisation of the Queensland coast by mining companies and other heavy industries. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Taiwan's president began traveling Saturday, and China is not happy about it. Tsai Ing-wen's week-long journey has her visiting three Pacific Island allies, Tuvalu, the Solomon Islands, and the Marshall Islands, via Honolulu and the U.S. territory of Guam. China claims sovereignty over self-ruled Taiwan. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, automakers from around the world have been showing off their new vehicles this past weekend at the 45th annual Tokyo Motor Show. Designers have been showcasing electronic cars with advanced artificial intelligence and at least one concept car with safety features for the world around it. Arash Arabasadi had his futuristic view of the show just before its opening.
This isn't the star of a new Transformers movie. Japanese manufacturer Toyota Gosei unveiled the Flesby 2 concept car ahead of this year's Tokyo Motor Show. It changes shape if you're parking, getting in, or driving fast. And it's got safety features even for those who are not riding in the car. We put airbags, which are mainly employed inside the car, on its exterior, such as its hood or fender, to protect the entire body, as we wanted to express our concept of safety.
The rubberized exterior cushions and bounces back from little fender benders while LED lights help drivers interact with their surroundings.
We wanted to create it to enable communication, not only between the car and the driver, but also between the car and pedestrians.
Science fiction the company hopes to produce by 2030. More than 36 car makers from around the world will showcase new designs this weekend. Japan's top automaker, Toyota, displays its futuristic Concept I. The car monitors the driver's face, body language, and voice to keep both human and machine on the road.
When the driver needs support from the vehicle, it automatically switches to automatic driving mode. As such, the vehicle and the human help each other and make the driving safe all the time.
Honda unveils its urban EV concept electric car, while Mazda reveals its new Skyactiv X engine, which is almost 30% more fuel efficient than the majority of today's stingiest combustion engines. Most of these cars are concepts, blueprints for the future, but when the venue's doors open Saturday to the public, the future will be here, as designers look to bring their visions to life on the assembly line. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The bones and ashes of Thailand's revered king were brought to their final resting place Sunday in the conclusion of a five-day funeral after a year of official mourning. The funeral ceremonies drew hundreds of thousands to the streets of Bangkok and millions more to shrines across the country. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a high-tech version of the lie detector test has been developed at Silver Logic Labs in Seattle, Washington. It's called Passive Polygraph. VOA's Faith Lapidus explains how it works.
The wires and belts of a lie detector machine could be replaced by a video camera and an algorithm.
You ever lied to your parents?
Yes.
What about?
About where I was? At a certain time in the morning.
So what we're doing is we're using the video footage, we're breaking it down into data and then using quant methods or quantitative math and deep learning from the videos to determine how a person's emotional responses are tied to some stimulus. So in this instance, it was questions.
This is not new technology. It was originally developed to gauge audience reactions to TV shows and movies. Using earlier studies identifying micro-expressions that betray emotions someone may want to conceal, the Silver Logic Labs algorithm analyzes facial expressions based on seven basic reactions, including anger, disgust, happiness, and fear.
We wanted to pan in really tight into her face so that we could get a lot of detail in that footage because we are going to be processing it and decomposing the emotional vectors to see the veracity of whether or not she believes in what she's saying.
Have you ever hurt somebody intentionally?
Yes.
Here, the algorithm detects sadness, suggesting, according to the tester, that the subject is not telling the truth as the baseline testing indicates she feels emotional discomfort when deceitful. The idea that a video camera can identify anxiety levels and emotional reactions in real time raises privacy concerns for some, but the company says those fears are unfounded.
Well, I think this is actually a super enhancement to civil rights, because cameras and computers aren't biased to race, ethnicity, age, gender, any of that.
The passive polygraph could play an active role in the search for truth in the future. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
At least 1 in 10 people globally lives near the coast in a low-lying area, and as the population increases and sea level rises, their homes are increasingly being threatened. The countries with the most people at risk include the United States, China, India, and Bangladesh, and Southeast Asian countries such as Vietnam and Indonesia. Scientists say climate change is to blame for the threat, and it has so far reaching implications. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains.
From floods to droughts, recent years have seen more of these extreme weather events.
There is no doubt that part of this is climate change. Winters are warmer. Snowpacks come later, they leave earlier. Droughts have tended to be more intense, especially here in California.
Scientists say while climate change cannot be blamed for every extreme weather event, it is definitely a factor.
It changes the odds. So the odds of heat waves are greater, the odds of stronger hurricanes are greater, the odds of more intense droughts and floods are greater.
That means communities in low-lying areas close to the coast worldwide are at a greater risk of the devastating effects of extreme weather.
We're living in a warmer world. We're living in a melting world. And of course, the unequivocal evidence is that sea levels are rising. We're living risky. We're living too close to the coast.
Scientists say although the Earth's climate does naturally fluctuate over hundreds of thousands of years,
we've never seen this much change over 100 years. And so the thing that worries me the most is not the next 1,000 years or the next ice age, but the next 100 years.
It's not natural. If it weren't for human activities, the world, under natural causes like changes in the sun and volcanoes, would have actually cooled slightly in recent decades. Warming is due to human activities, primarily to carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases and particles that mankind has put into the atmosphere.
Rising sea levels and more extreme weather have impacts that go beyond floods.
We have greater disease, spread of disease. We have deteriorating air quality because of higher temperatures.
One of the biggest impacts of sea level rise on
global agriculture must also adapt to a changing world. As seen in this film produced by the Aquarium of the Pacific, sea level rise in Bangladesh is causing more salinity in the soil. Farmers can no longer plant their regular crops and have switched to grains more resilient to salinity. Some countries are working to mitigate the effects of climate change. In Indonesia, American and Indonesian scientists and students are working to restore seagrass beds. Seagrass protects the shore from storm surges and helps take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
We can't make it go away instantly. It takes a long time, but we can act to reduce the severity of climate change.
Scientists say the solution is reducing the amount of fossil fuels and increasing the use of renewable energies. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We thank you for joining us today. And if for some reason you've missed part of our program, you can catch it all by downloading it from iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also find us at VOA Asia Facebook and online at our website, voanews.com. We also invite you to write to us. We'd love to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook is a great way to get in touch with us. You can also send us an email the old-fashioned way at voanews@voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Aydin Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. We also have a host of great interns that we love to thank each and every day. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.